first time in over 8 years, the U.S. men's national team is headed to a knockout round of the World Cup. David Goss, Bobby Warshaw, Matt Doyle, and Andrew Wiebe with you. Shout out to everyone out there listening to Club and Country today, our daily World Cup reaction show, as well as to everyone listening in the Extra Time feed right now. Normally, we've got categories. We've got scripts. We've got reads. We've got everything else to do for our shows. But today's a little different because it's a little simple. We've all been waiting at least 5 years. Some of us have been waiting eight. Some of us maybe even longer for the moment that we saw today. And it is pretty special what went down. So we are going to dig into everything U.S. men's national team versus Iran. We're going to talk about what happened, how we got here the last few years, some of the heroes on and off the field, as well as, of course, looking ahead to Bobby's beloved Netherlands on Saturday. It was a matchup made in heaven. But let's start out with an opening thought for all of us and where you're at and where your mind is going as the U.S. finishes in second place in Group B behind England and advances to the next round. For me, it's the 5+ years, some of the lowest points in U.S. men's national team history. It is Kuva, which was the lowest point, arguably, in U.S. men's national team history. It was the unknown. It was a lot of other things. And we'll talk about a lot of that. But the distillation of that, to me today, is Christian Pulisic, a player who had to be on the field and experience Kuva when he thought he was headed to a career of all highs, a player who has been built up, promoted, pressured, everything else, like the rest of this team in this program, over the last 5 years to expect more, to need more, to do more, to take things to an unprecedented level. And it's what we love about sports and when you can believe in something, which is your biggest name, your biggest star stepping up in the biggest moments, and not just stepping up and playing well, physically putting his body on the line to get the U.S. across the line and drag this team to the point that I think a lot of people think they deserve to be at and should prove that they should be at. We've hearing that he is heading to the hospital right now, so we're hoping for the best for Christian Pulisic, but this is his land in Algeria game moment, right? This is his goal against Portugal for Brian McBride moment. This is the moment that will probably cement him for many U.S. fans and be mentioned over and over again and played over and over again. And this is what we all want. And this is why you have to get to this stage, to give yourself the opportunity to do it. But then you have to finish. And there's a lot of people we're going to talk about today. But to me, it all starts with Christian Pulisic and his ability to step up in the biggest moment.
And the way it happened, and putting his body on the line, and the intensity behind it. It wasn't just a moment of magic. It was him sacrificing himself for the team, which I think added to the memory and the emotion that we'll all take with us from this game.
Oh, God. Speaking of emotion, can we just – how did you guys experience this? Because by the end of this game, I was staring at my desk, like burning a hole in the pine in front of me. I could not watch. I could not think about anything else. All I could do was listen. And when I hear – oh my, I was listening to the watch along as well, and I hear Steven Betisher going, he's a minute ahead of me. He says, they're arguing for a call, and my heart sank. This entire game, I got a new watch today, and it measures your heartbeat. I was watching the heartbeat on this the whole time. My resting heartbeat in the dramatic moments, like, flew up, and I'm standing here.
Weeby burned 6,000 calories during this game.
I did Orange Theory by sitting here and watching this game. The level of elation I feel right now, I haven't felt in soccer, well, maybe outside of watching Gareth Bale do that thing in the MLS Cup. I haven't felt that since I was in the stands in Salvador, since I was there in 2014. I haven't felt that level of pride, as you said, Bobby, in the team, in the players, in the program, in what we're doing. And there are all these moments that stand out to me, like in this moment afterwards. And I've just kind of been cycling through them. And one of them actually is Landon Donovan being left at home ahead of that 2014 tournament and just thinking, my God, are we led by a charlatan? And it turned out we were led by a complete charlatan in Jurgen Klinsmann, and that only becomes more apparent by the day. But in Salvador, you lose to Belgium, and I think there was this feeling for me, for a lot of people, of, oh, what could have been? Oh, what if Wando finishes that chance? Oh, what if we were able to get past Belgium? Are we on that level? Okay, we're not on that level, but by God, in 2018 we will be on that level. We weren't on the level. Klinsmann gone. Bruce Arena is the only one that can save us. I remember clearly Costa Rica at Red Bull Arena. I remember being embarrassed by the performance, by basically being yelled out of the parking lot by Costa Rica fans in the most like good-natured way possible, by the way. I mean, Pura Vida, they were nice about it, but they shamed us, and we were shamed. It was a veteran team slumping. I remember you go to Bruce, he's your only option left, and then you have Cuva, and you have this gaping hole in our soccer culture. Thank God for the U.S. women. Just an absolute chasm. I remember that night. I remember being shocked but not surprised and being on set with you guys, and I can't even remember who was there at that time, and just sort of feeling like, what the hell just happened, and what does it mean? What does it mean when we don't go to a World Cup? What does it mean when all this momentum we felt was building just gets chopped out from underneath us, and we're the ones wielding the axe? I remember the Dave Sarakin era, and it's just like, where are we going? What are we doing? What is the direction here? Is this progress? No offense to Dave, but I don't think anybody knew what the hell was going on. And then Greg gets hired, and there's all this backlash, and I understood some of it, but I knew that Greg was a smart guy, and I just thought, you know, all we want is progress. All we want is a path. We have all this raw material. We have all these people, despite the reputation that soccer sometimes gets in this country, who love the game and are desperate for it to succeed and are throwing their backs into this thing. And money and effort and expertise. Are we going the right direction? And I think that's what's been so frustrating for so many years, is it just felt scattershot. It just felt like we were like, oh, yeah, okay, well, hopefully this works. And, you know, the academy side of things took time to build, and then it starts to take shape in this team, and you see this young group, and you see the progress, and you see the transfers, and you see players playing at the top level of the game, and you start to think, we can do this. If we get back to the World Cup, this is a team that can sort of be a team of our dreams, certainly in 22, but hopefully even in 2026. God knows we don't need to think about that right now. And there are bumps, but there are wins against Mexico, and there's freaking COVID. And COVID is COVID. And I think we can all understand how that disrupted our own lives. And it's, I think, hard to understand unless you were there how it disrupted this program. And they climb and they climb and they qualify for the World Cup and they get into this World Cup. But we're all, you know, existentially challenged because of games against Japan and Saudi Arabia. And here we are. And it's freaking awesome, man. It just like, I had to experience it by myself, and that sucked. I'm not going to lie. I wish I was in a studio with you guys. I wish I was throwing beers in the air. I know that so many people that are listening right now had that experience. But we freaking did it. We have this opportunity, and this progress that we've built it on, the blocks weren't like, you know, lined up, ready for us just to stomp up it. Here we go. We got a great, you know, we have a national team that can challenge for something important. No, we had to jam them in place. We had to hop from block to block. We had to skip a couple because we screwed that up. But the blocks going forward are there. And this is, to me, just like, this is the first little hint of what this generation, this era of our soccer culture can do. And I'm ranting because I'm excited. I'm ranting because I'm overjoyed. I'm ranting more, because we got Bobby's, because orange is Bobby's favorite color. Red, white, and blue are coming for him, baby.
I'm not going to go along with that bit during the show, okay, guys. Right. Let's just acknowledge that now. That bit died.
Cheers.
I'll say you said a lot of things here that I agree with. The one I disagree with is that this is not a little bit of a taste. Like, this is the taste. This is what we wanted to see in order to see progress. You get out of the group. The way they did it is what's left me so impressed. I thought they were the better team in 5 of 6 halves that they played. And that includes the first half against Wales. I don't think they were the better team in the second half of this game. But Greg Berhalter said on the post game, he was interviewed by Fox, and he said, you know, the first half we showed what our soccer is, and the second half we showed what our determination is. And I think that about sums it up. And it was nice to see that again from a U.S. team, and to see those two, it's not even the same coin, but to see those two attributes sort of filtering into this extraordinarily young side, nothing's going to bury the past of the ghosts of Cuva. Like, that'll be with us forever. But this was under, like, this whole group stage was proof that the lessons have been learned. And on a personal level, it validated my own worldview about soccer, which is that you don't have to have the smartest coach in the world who wants to play the absolute best system in the world. What you need is a coach who has a system and who has clarity about what that system is. And that's what Greg Berhalter has brought, right? Like, I would argue with individual choices he's made. I would argue even with the lineup today, like if it was me against Duran, we would have been playing two trees at center forward and two trees at center back, and we would be playing for set pieces because that's what tournament soccer is. But that's not what Greg Berhalter's vision was. And he bought into that vision from day one, and it's very clear that every player on this roster bought into that vision as well. And they went out and they executed it. And if you have 11 players, or 16 players because of five subs now, or 26 because that's the size of the roster, buying into a vision like that, you're going to end up playing some good soccer. And good soccer, if the soccer gods smile upon you, can lead to success. And that's what we had. We had a very successful group stage. It is, with all due respect to 2002 and 2010 and 1994 and even 2014, this is the most confident I've been in a team getting out of the group stage that I've ever seen. They might not get past the Dutch, who are, again, Bobby Warshaw's favorite team. I'm not going to say I don't care. Obviously, I care. I desperately want them to get past the Dutch. But they're going out there and they're executing on something that is more than just their innate talent. They're executing upon a vision. And there's nothing I love more in sports, particularly soccer and basketball. Shout out to the Celtics here and there, Andy. I got you. Who, when 11 players are using the same brain and the same blueprint to create a whole that is greater than the sum of their parts. And it's not happening for 90 minutes. And there are moments in an attack, especially where it leaves you wanting a little bit more, but it's happening enough for this U.S. team. And it's just wonderful to see. It's why I love soccer. It's why soccer is the best sport, when you could take that many people and that many variables and turn them into a collective. It's just absolutely wonderful, and I'm so juiced about that.
A young team too. I mean, have we said that this is the youngest 11?
I think this was the youngest 11 that was fielded in this tournament.
I mean,
right?
that alone, if you're talking about hope, which is I think what had been in large part distinguished, I mean, that's where you start to feel this hope being sort of welling up. And it's sort of been there, been on the surface, been trying to overflow. You had those games against Mexico and we had the highs, but there was always, I don't know if it's the fan base, I don't know if it's our own existentialism dragging us down. Like, F that. You can't drag me down now, okay? I will not be dragged down. When you see guys like this, when you see Christian Pulisic, who just put out, I don't know if it's Snapchat, he's, you know, of that generation, so I assume it's Snapchat, in a hospital bed, hooked up with wires, tweeting out, let's effing go, I'll be there against the Netherlands. Like, you know, put the brick wall up, baby.
What about LeBron tweeting out, go USMNT, keep it up? Like, and that's what the World Cup brings, right? It is a platform that no other soccer event has. I'd argue no other sport event has. But that's always why I think for all of us sitting here, we've always rallied around the national team as well as the World Cup. Because it is those tentpole events and those tentpole moments. And Joel, you talked a lot about where we're at and where we're going. And I don't think this erases the past, but I do think this is the reset moment. And you talk about a team and a generation, and we talk about 2014, like these players are going to be around for 8, 10, 12 years. Not all of them. Also, not all of them will be players on this team, because I have said many times, it's not a golden generation. It's the beginning of a pipeline. But I think a lot of people in 2010 and 2014 perceived the U.S. out of the 0-2 team. Right. It was the end and the push. And now I believe this is that reset point, where this is the point that people are going to talk about the USMNT forward, whether it's building into 2026 or beyond. And they needed it. And you, at some point, you just need to stop having moral victories. and being able to explain away how well you played, but you drew, or being able to explain away, well, this guy was hurt and we couldn't bring this striker, so we would have played well, but we didn't. At some point, you need to get rid of those. And that's what today, I think, accomplishes for a lot of the program, a lot of people that work in the sport, which I think releases a lot of pressure to go and do your best work now, which was what was necessary. And I think that's what Greg Berhalter had to grit and grind his way through. That's what these players had to grit and grind their way through. Now they've gotten there. And as you say, Doyle, of like that confidence, they've got nothing to lose. And that's very rare in sports. And so they can go out and play from here on out. And I think play their best style, which is attack and sort of maybe even be stupid about stuff and not a ton, but go after things, because the fear of losing should be gone, because this was the accomplishment that was necessary. Doyle, did you want to say something?
No, I'm thinking through what you said. I'm thinking through all of it. I'm kind of waiting for Bobby to go, because I could see the gears turning with him. I'll make one more point. To borrow from Jason Kreis after the Olympic failure of 2 years or a year and a half ago, like, you're going to lose a bunch in life. And the U.S. spent a decade losing. And I think learning the wrong things from those defeats. And I don't just mean on the field. I mean hiring the wrong managers and buying sort of the wrong ticket. All I want from any sports team that I watch is some sort of confirmation that you're learning the lessons of those defeats. And it does feel like that's what we've seen from this. It does feel like this is a different era because of that, because playing too open in Kuva, like, oh, you can't do that. You have to have control of the game, even if you don't have control of the ball. Integrating young players, being active in recruiting, but not promising playing time for switching dual nationals. Like, and being like, we want to disorganize opponents with the ball and not just have that be buzzwords, even if, again, it doesn't happen all the time. I like getting confirmation that we have learned those lessons, and it gives me hope for better things in the future because those lessons have been learned. And that's whether Greg Berhalter is still coach after this tournament or not. It just feels like there's been some maturity in how the national team is run. And it's like, what a new day that is.
I've been enjoying listening to you guys talk about this. I think the energy is amazing, and I wanted to soak all of that in. I'm a little bit worried that there was a touch of overemphasis, because I do think that this is where the U.S. men's national team should be, and I do want to put that into context. Mm-hmm. Absolutely amazing three games, amazing day. I'm so proud of everything, but I do think the best part of what we saw today, but also from all three games really, was that this is what it should look like. Right? It had a sense of normalcy to it, a sense of consistency, a sense of, if you play this group, if you play these teams 10 times, the way it shaped out, the United States makes it out 8 of them because they were the better team, because they had control of the game, because they did everything right. So I'm totally okay with you guys celebrating everything. I really love the energy, but it is important to put in the context of like, okay, now we're back to table stakes. Right. And that's what this is. This is the U.S. men's national team soccer program. They should make it to the round of 16 every time. And they should do it in a way that looks normal and looks controlled, which is what we saw today. And that was the freaking cool part. The fact that they had control through every single phrase, because we have been proud of this team for the human elements many times before, for the intensity, for the determination, for the teamwork, for the fitness. But to be proud for the soccer reasons, to be proud because of the rest defense, to be proud because of the structure, to be proud because of the wide overloads and playing through lines and bouncing and third man runs. Right. This is the stuff where if we think about where the program is, where the program should be, where the program should go, it's those elements, right? It's those elements of control, of football, of technique that are the foundation and the moving point. So you guys are right to celebrate, because we should take every moment we can to celebrate these things. But there's also a point to pick up our heads and say, all right, this is normal. This is table stakes. What's next?
I think the
that got me juiced.
Yeah, that got me.
Bobby waited 20 minutes to talk on this show, and then he came 102 mile an hour heat up in the zone. I like it.
So what gets me? I mean, I think that was a good
call. He's muted, Mike.
Yeah.
Oh boy, somebody was changing laundry in my basement. Either way, Bobby, yes, and I think where I sort of like my natural inclination to follow that point, and I completely agree with you, is that the guys that reset the stakes for us. Is this young generation, the guys that took on that burden, wasn't a group of veterans, the burden of Kuva, the burden of COVID even, the burden of what is U.S. men's soccer going to be? Is this young group of guys that genuinely look like they love each other, that genuinely look like they that they have real personality, that represent our country in a way that, again, you know, to go to the soccer side, but to go to the people side that I am proud of. You know, I am proud of Tyler Adams for who he is as a person on the dais, just as much as I'm proud of him as a dude that's going to like hold you up at knife point in the middle of that field when you got the ball and you think you're going to do something with it. Like I'm proud of Weston McKennie for the way he has sort of represented U.S. players bouncing through different leagues where maybe you didn't think he was going to have that opportunity, fighting his way into Schalke, going to Juventus, flying. I'm proud of all these guys because they all have these different tracks that frankly didn't really seem that possible. Even we want to throw it back 8 years ago. How are players going to ever get to these clubs? How are they going to get the experiences so that when it is time to execute on that soccer level, it's old hat for them in a certain way. And to have it be a young group, I mean, it's just, there's something about that. There's something about watching guys grow up and then watching them sort of come good on the level you thought they could do it at. And then saying, okay, cool. Table stakes are set. How far can you go? How much can you grow that stack? Like, you know, Greg talked about it multiple times before this tournament. There are two tournaments. We got through one of them. There's a whole nother tournament, and God knows anything can happen. And like that potential and that look into the future, both immediate, the short term, but also the medium and the long term in U.S. soccer, and honestly, Canadian soccer as well, though their tournament didn't end the same way. I mean, that is just thrilling. That is like, God, I'm so glad I've been, I and all of us and all the people listening and everybody who loves the sport have had their shoulders on the wall and have been pushing and pushing and pushing for that little bit of budge. And it now feels like, you know, we got it rolling, man. Like, I know this is that moment that's going to make us feel this way. And there's still a lot of work to be done in every level of the game, but we've got that little budge. And when you get that little bit, sometimes it feels like that, you know, that sled's just going to start pushing.
We'd be talking about Tyler Adams in there. Yeah, you know, young captain, as we said, the youngest team for a start average age of a starting team at this World Cup. And we've talked a lot about big picture. We've talked a lot about where we are. Let's talk about some other individuals. We talked about it a little bit before we got on. Doyle, who do you want to lead with?
There's so many of them, right? And like we could go through just about everyone on the team.
Don't worry, Weeby's here. We will.
Yeah, he's going to list them all.
Let me just prepare. I got to get
this list voice.
I'm going to go down the list a little bit. Matt Turner's distribution through three games, this is what kept the kid out of the lineup. But if you go back to the start of the sequence on the game's only goal, it comes, 36, 37 minutes into the game. It is the first time that Iran is really pressing the U.S. way upfield. And as soon as that happened, you saw it click with Turner and Ream and Carter Vickers. Like, they understood immediately what pattern to go into. They spread Iran out, and Turner hit this inch-perfect 40, 50-yard ball right to Tim Weah, who was checking into the pocket, one touch to Yunus Musa, and then the U.S. is off. And they're not off running in a transition moment, which we will talk more about later, because this team needs to get more out of transition moments if they're going to keep winning. But they're going upfield in a controlled manner that is forcing Iran to retreat into a shell. It's forcing them to just retreat to get back into their shape and not into a position where they can press the ball. And the goal doesn't happen without that distribution from Matt Turner. And we're three games into this. He made one relatively difficult save, and that came against England late in the first half. Like, Matt Turner three games in, and this goes back to what I'm saying about the U.S. feeling like a different team in terms of the control they can exert against World Cup caliber sides, is like three games into it, Matt Turner has been a bigger asset for his distribution than he is for his shot stopping. Like, we could have had any average MLS keeper in there for the shots Matt Turner has faced, and you would expect, you know, 1-1, 0-0, 1-0. But his distribution opened this game up for the one defining moment of the game. It's fantastic to see. And this, like, I was beating the Matt Turner drum for the U.S. before just about anybody. It wasn't because of distribution like that. It was for his shot stopping. And for us to be here now, and we haven't had him to be a hero, well, I guess that is about everybody else, isn't it? But it was nice to see him hit the type of pass that modern elite goalkeepers are supposed to hit.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I want to turn to the player you mentioned to get on the end of that clipped pass for the first goal, Timothy Weah.
Yep.
Because when you mentioned that, I had forgotten that Timothy Weah got on the end of it, because he had been doing so many other things throughout the game. He has done so much for this team in the first two games, and it didn't occur to me that he also dropped in and received balls like that, but it shouldn't surprise me because he's a player that can do everything. And we have talked about Christian Pulisic, rightfully so. We have talked about Weston McKennie. We have talked about so many players, and I really want to make sure we talk about Timothy Weah, because he is ultimately the one who has been on the end of so many of these attacking chances. That as the U.S. has been dangerous in the final third, he has either been the one combining in possession, or more specifically and more often, offering the verticality. Because Greg Berhalter made a big tenet of this team, the verticality, the ability for them to play behind defenses, the ability for them to play quickly. And there was a risk early on when he made that, when he turned that lever up for the team, that the soccer was going to get ugly, that it was going to get a little bit direct, that they were going to lose their ability to play in possession. But when you have a player like Timothy Weah, who offers the verticality, who offers the pace, who can stretch a back line, but can also ball, and is also just straight up good at soccer, it provides so much for your team, and I want to make sure he gets the recognition. Plus, on top of that, everything he's offered defensively, to change his role and to have to now play as one of the two highest players, to make sure that he can both press the ball and cover shadow a player behind him. Little nuances that you can't just ask anyone to do or anybody to learn in 3 weeks and in 3 days, and he's done it. And Weah has been one of the key players that's helped this team perform over the three games.
He plays like someone who was raised by a guy with the equivalent of a soccer PhD. Mm-hmm. You know, he plays like someone whose father is a former Ballon d'Or winner. Like, he's like, even when his touch is off, which it was today, he brings so much to the team for everything you just listed, Bobby.
And also, let's talk about the fact we wouldn't be here. The U.S. wouldn't be here if he doesn't play the way he does in qualifying in some of the biggest moments. He carried the team when other guys struggled early in that round of qualifying. I believe it was the assist against Mexico and an assist against Costa Rica that opened up the game for this team. And if he doesn't play the way he does defensively, I don't know that Dest is even on the field half the time as well, who I thought was very good again.
It's a really good point. It's a really good point.
And that's what he learned at Lille, one of the best defensive teams in the league. They won a title because of their defending from the front and his flexibility and his versatility. I thought Dest was really good again today, as I said. He's obviously special in possession. He battles on defense. Okay, I'm not going to agree with every decision he makes, but I'm not Serginho Dest, and there's a reason why.
The header that he won on the goal line, when he just nudges and puts off,
I don't think he touches the ball. He just challenges.
Yeah, he was a step behind. He refocuses. He accelerates, and he just puts off the attacker enough. Those are the types of things you've been dying to see from him for 4 years, and he's provided it. And it was wonderful to watch.
Do you think he's been dying for 4 years to potentially play the Dutch in a World Cup game?
Yeah, by the way, that's pretty good, right?
Yeah.
I think Greg Berhalter already has quoted about it, because he's already been asked about it and what it could be. I think he's a special player, and you see it in those moments, especially sometimes our center backs don't want to build in every position, and he takes pressure and beats them and goes inside and resets the game and starts over. And I thought a massive part of this game to start was the variance in the attack. It wasn't hitting deep crosses over and over. It wasn't 100% get to the end line and pull it back, which is, I think, what we saw against England. There was a lot of variance to it. I thought Dest was a part of that. I thought Weah was a big part of that. And I thought Josh Sargent was as well. He played confidently. He was confident. His first touch was clean enough to set him up to create plays, whether it's for himself or for his teammates. The one where he turns, his shot's deflected. I have no idea what Wea is doing. It's probably offside in the end. The header from inside the box on the floating ball. But I thought Josh Sargent was really good finding the ball on both sides of the field to help create for the wingers, to help create for the fullbacks, the hold-up play. He won a lot of headers when pressure had to be broken or Sargent went long, or Turner went long and was able to keep the ball alive, which you cannot say the same for Haji Wright over the course of this World Cup or anyone else really for the U.S. in the attack. Josh Sargent, I'm hoping he's healthy. Either way, this was a crowning moment for him. And when I think of Timothy Wea and Josh Sargent, I think back really far to a miserable Bolivia friendly in 2018, right before the World Cup, because the U.S. hadn't qualified. And I watched them and said, Wea is a great attacking winger. Sargent's a great creative center forward. That's the future. It hasn't been linear for Josh Sargent at all. And so for him to build himself back and believe in it and continue to not speak out in the media against the coaching staff or against other players, to sort of keep his head down and continue to fight and get to this point and then play the role that's necessary of him. I just think it was a really good day for him.
And the way,
go ahead.
And I just want to add on Sargent, the way he's grown as a player. Doyle talked about Matt Turner growing in the last few years with his feet. Yeah. The way that Sargent has increased his, I think, conviction in his movements is the right word. Yeah. Yep. Right. The intensity of what he does off of the ball, just as small as going from an 85% stride to a 97% sprint, has made a huge difference for him. And you can see that every loose ball, every ball into the second layer, every time he has to chase into a duel, he now does it with 90, you know, with at almost full speed. He makes sure he gets his body involved. He's doing the little nuances to win the duels. And the fact that we all knew that he had the ability, but he has added those little details and grown in confidence, has taken into the player we've seen over these two games.
I just keep thinking about, as we talk about these guys, and you could go through the whole team, and really this is what World Cups are about in large part, because it is just 270 minutes. And like, this was supposed to be in the summer, now it's the winter. Timing is everything. And we sort of know that about life, but there were long stretches of this qualification process, of this buildup process, where it was like, who are we going to have? You know, we're fortunate to be in this situation now with all these guys in form, somewhat healthy, depending on the guy, but all available to have Josh Sargent find a situation in the championship where he can be this player, to have Timothy Wea come back from injury at the right time when, my God, did it feel like he was ever going to be healthy for an extended period of time for Lille. It honestly, it didn't. You didn't know if you were going to have him. To get them all here at this time, like, sometimes it's a confluence of events. So as you said, Bobby, like, hey, this is the like standard we want to hold to. But also, man, sometimes you just need to have a little good fortune on the luck side. I just want to say something as I watch Twitter and I'm listening to you guys. And the iconic image from this game is not going to be Christian Pulisic in the goal. It's going to be Christian Pulisic in the hospital. Every single mainstream media outlet, sports outlet, random person, whoever, is tweeting this image of Christian Pulisic in the hospital right now. And it is all going to build up to the Netherlands. And I'm going to talk about Tyler Adams, but I feel like we got to hit Christian a little bit, because one of the images that I was talking about in the last 8 years that stands out is Christian on the field in Cuba, Christian crying in the shower, all these veterans saying, hey, I went and comforted Christian. He is the future. And I remember those heady early days of like, oh my God, we have a superstar on our hands. And I wonder what it's like. And I don't think that Christian has ever really said publicly what it has been like to be him all these years. With the pressure of the national,
I got a
team.
Commercial about it, Weeby.
I know what kind of chocolate times. He likes, okay, Doyle? I know what kind of chocolate he likes. And like Volkswagen and him are, you know, buddy-buddy, et cetera. But do I really know how he's had to weather this, how he's held this, the world that's been on his shoulders? Nobody does but him. And there was a moment in that first half where he puts his head down and he's driving forward, and I'm like, oh, God, the ball's right there. Pass it. Don't do like against Wales. And he loses it. And I'm like, is this going to be a replay? And you know, look, was he perfect? No. But when the moment came, when the guy had to make the run, when he had to recognize the moment and he had to finish, he did it. And that's a big poetic full circle moment for me of a guy who was the young one, who was the rising star, who was supposed to sort of like coast into the World Cup on the backs of these veterans who had done it before, and then maybe launch himself in that moment in Russia. And it just never happened. And he sort of had to do it alone in a lot of ways in the in terms of the spotlight, not in terms of the team structure overall, but in terms of the spotlight. I mean, who are they passing the Thanksgiving dinner to on the Fox commercial? It's Christian Pulisic.
Man, Weeby loves that commercial. I bet you he gets stoked every time it comes on. It's good stuff.
It's just good stuff.
And he
took a little shtick early in this tournament, and he hasn't always been at his best, and his club situation has been hard. But for him to get that moment, I thought was really special. And I thought for Tyler Adams to get the armband has been sort of the most, I mean, it set the tone to me for the tournament in a lot of ways. The recognition of his peers, the recognition of Greg Berhalter, that this is the guy. This is sort of the metronome. This, like, emotionally, physically, soccer-wise, this is the epicenter. Like, everything is, it comes from what he provides attitude-wise, ground coverage, aggression, ability to snuff out attacks, protect the back line. He found his place, and this goes back to timing. He found his place at the club level. RB Leipzig wasn't working, man. Pretty clear. That wasn't going to be the spot. Timing. Bielsa leaves Leeds. Jesse Marsh takes over. They have this relationship. He gets to the Premier League. Can he find his level? Can he stay fit? Talking to Jesse before this tournament, he had a very detailed idea about what it took for Tyler Adams to stay fit as far as training load, game load, and the flags that it took. So he finds his fitness, he finds his form, he finds his manager, he finds his league. His mentality has always been this way, and he is the extinguisher of hope. Every time an opponent thinks they have an opening, they have a break, they have a moment, they have an opportunity, Tyler Adams this tournament has been there to poke it away, to shoulder you off the ball, to foul you, to get in your face, to tell you not this time. As I said, he's the guy with the blade in your belly, like not another step.
Or for Cameron Carter-Vickers. When he's like, bro, you need to speak up behind me. What is happening right now?
But that's that like personality and attitude and mentality that we knew he had. And that and it's almost like he needed the stage to show it on this level. He was given the stage. And to me, he is the star. I
agree with you. I would say, obviously, for someone, I covered his first professional soccer game. I've watched him now for years, and he's still young. He's always been older than his age. And for a team that is the youngest squad, they needed someone to be a veteran leader. And he is a fake one because he's not really a veteran. He just has that personality. And he always had. I talked with Lloyd Sam earlier today. He's telling the story about when he took Felipe Martins down, when Felipe tried to sort of show him up on his first few days of training. And then all the stories from there on of him not acting like a rookie or not acting like a young player. He's always been this person. This team needed that. And it wasn't going to just happen, right? You could have brought someone in who maybe didn't deserve to be on the field, but could have been that presence. They didn't need to do that because Tyler Adams existed in this one. He was elite, I thought, in this game. I thought this was his best game of the tournament. Let's talk about the soccer. We're 40 minutes in, and this is exactly where we stand because that's what this moment is, right?
40 minutes of vibes. 40 minutes of vibes is what the people want.
Now that we're all through one glass of water, we can get into the game.
I did have to put a little water in this whiskey. Yeah, I was like, it's like 4 o'clock. Like,
I had to put a little whiskey in my water.
You guys, I got a playoff men's league game tonight. No sub. So trust me, I feel you all. Bobby, get us started. Like, the U.S. had to win.
Mm-hmm.
Iran could tie. That was a factor. The U.S. had only scored one goal from open play.
Yeah.
What did Greg Berhalter do in this game and sort of what was this 90 minutes?
Yeah, the first task, and I want to talk about the specifics because I thought they were very compelling. But the first task that we talked about yesterday and we have to start with today is that the United States matched or exceeded Iran's intensity. Number one, right? Based on the players they have, the ideas, they needed to match the intensity, and they did that, which was not a given coming into this game. So looking at the specifics, when I think about what we saw today and over the three games, what has this team done so well? And the main thing I keep coming back to is their ability to tie together every phase of the game. In that when they have the ball, they are set up in their starting positions and their decisions where to pass, that if they lose it, they can get it right back. That when they defend, they are already in positions and taking on runs, that when they win it, they can then transition to attack. That yes, maybe they weren't all the way turned up in some phases. Did they create as many chances as they want in possession? No. Did they create as many chances as they want in transition? No. But the fact that all the things were tied together so that they did not have any weaknesses over these three games was really beautiful to watch. And it all comes from the building blocks, as Weeby talked about earlier, the building blocks that they've added to each other. That there have been windows when things did not go well. There have been games when they did not play well. But adding the building blocks on top of each other, so then when it comes to these three games, they are fully unified and prepared to move in between the phases of the game so that there absolutely are no weaknesses on the field.
Yeah. The word process in sports has become a shibboleth or a curse word and everything in between because of what it meant in the NBA. But like, if you, unless you luck into just a absolutely generational group of players, 15 at once, everything, like, you can't go from Kuva to this without having a process. And that's what Bobby's talking about. And what we saw on the field today was that process come to life, at least for 45 minutes, right? Because with Iran playing as desperate as they were in the second half, the game enters a tactics-free zone against all but the very best teams in the world. But for that 45 minutes, the ability to, for me, it's what Bobby was saying about the ability to always be in possession to immediately win the ball back when you're taking a risk. That is the sign of a really well-drilled team. And like, there are two signs of, I think, a really well-drilled, well-structured team. That and the ability to repeatedly create high-value chances by concerted and purposeful movement on and of and off the ball. And the U.S., you could see it. It's almost there. We have moments where they do it, including on the goal, though it's not always coming off. But through five halves of soccer, the defensive part of it, where it's like these guys are just in complete lockstep, and Iran had no way out. I don't think Iran came out from the whistle trying to sit back, but within 4 or 5 minutes, the U.S. had gotten so much of the ball, and Reem was hitting into the pockets, and Musa was turning guys every, like, he's so good at checking his shoulder now, which he didn't do this time last year. Like, he's always turning the right way when he receives the ball, and that's driving forward, and that's bringing guys in, and that's allowing, I don't know if you guys, like, I'm sure you did, both fullbacks were going up. Like, this was a 2-3-5 build out. This was not a 3-2-5, right? Both fullbacks were going up, which is a change from what we saw in the first two games. And they were able to do that because they're so well drilled and they're so on the same page. And for 45 minutes, man, Iran had absolutely no answer.
And with the two fullbacks going all the way up, the main adjustment to, again, tie everything together was that Weston McKennie dropped off.
Yep.
That he effectively joined Tyler Adams in a double pivot when they were in the progression phase, when they had set possession trying to create chances, they dropped Weston McKennie into more of what really looked like a deep line playmaker. And I'll acknowledge that 20 minutes into the game, I was screaming at the television, Weston, this is not your role, right? I understand why you're doing it in terms of the rest defense. I understand that you want to be in a position to win the ball back, but that is not where he excels, picking the ball up, picking up his head and finding passes, right? He excels getting into the box. Then of course, how does the U.S. win the game? It's exactly the opposite of that, which is he does pick up the ball in a deep position. He does find the perfect pass. And there are two other players on the end of it. But I thought that was a significant decision by Berhalter, again, to change the starting positions, move the outside backs up, drop Weston McKennie deeper, and it paid off.
It also opened up that space for Musa on the right. And we know Weston and Musa both want to play in that same space. That's just where they're comfortable. Musa played out there as a winger for a while, unfortunately for Valencia. And the ability of him, Dest and Weah to interchange and all of them to swap off and lay off and one touch and move. It doesn't lead to a goal yet. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling it coming, but it is, I think, one of the best attributes the U.S. can put out there in terms of in the attack. And so it solved two of those issues there where you don't really have to deal with Weston and Musa being in the same area, and it pulls Weston out of there and it opened that up for Musa. And it felt like that's where the goal was going to come from. Credit to Musa and Weah for recognizing the moment and everyone overloading into the center of the field on the goal so that Dest has 50% of the field to operate against one defender and Weston hits the ball. But literally every player from the U.S. was on the left side of the field when that goal happens, and that opens up the space for Dest, and Musa recognizes that, and it's really good. But their entire game together was really impressive.
Can we just give credit to a guy that I saw watching in Frisco or Dallas or wherever he was and sort of going through the same emotional states that we all were, which is Nico Estevez? Mm-hmm. I mean, Yunus Musa is not a slam dunk.
Yeah.
Hey, U.S. is going to get him. He wants to come into the program. Like, from day one, he's going to be a U.S. international guy. Like, Nico Estevez had the connections in Valencia, understood there was an opportunity, did the work, recruited. To go back to what you were saying earlier, I think it was you, Dave, about, you know, not just handing out caps or opportunities or saying, hey, you come in, we'll cap you, you're going to the World Cup, don't worry about it. Like, you know, Julian Green style, charlatan. I want to go back to Jurgen Klinsmann on that front. But to have a plan, to have a process.
Jurgen taking L's today as well. Let's go, Club and Country today.
Let's just hang all over the rim on him. To have a process and a plan and then have the humility and sort of the human connection with these players to go to him and say, we think you're special. We think you can impact this program. We think you fit with our guys. Here is what we can do for you. Come to camp. Meet the guys. Remember when he didn't play? Remember when he was in the team and he didn't play? And everybody lost their
It was
Wavy's working blue.
Nice. It was Nations League, which would have cap-tied him. He did not play. Then he played in the friendly.
And everybody lost it. Greg Burrow, what are you doing? How could you not play him? You gotta cap-tie this guy. He understood the human aspect of this. And look what Yunus Musa is for this program now. The kid is 20 years old. He played 2 World Cup games at 19. And to have a staff, and it's not just, hey, look what Greg Berhalter did, but it's also to have a staff, to have an understanding, to have guys that realize, hey, this is how we're doing it. These are the wins are taking us. Let's do it the right way, and rewards will come. Man, that is we get to watch Yunus Musa in red, white, and blue for probably a decade plus now.
And to provide this,
it just, God, it boggles the mind.
I do want to, the quick background there is that Nico Estevez worked at Valencia before he came to the U.S. and Yunus Musa plays at Valencia. So that was the connection there. And he was the main recruiter that got Yunus Musa into the team.
And
the
Continue.
I just want to say, I was going to add another piece about the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, sorry. I took it. I got excited.
I thought the second defining trait for the U.S. was the starting spots in possession, which was the outside backs higher and Weston McKennie drop in. I thought the bravery and what really looked like intentionality for the three midfielders to play through each other and keep the ball central was a key part of this game. Because one of my strong hypotheses about soccer that's really hard to prove is that the more you can connect through the middle, the better off you are because the goal is in the middle of the field. So if you can drive through there, you're in a good position. But B, if you lose the ball, you're often in good spots to win it back. It just takes the guts to play those balls between the lines or to play an up and a bounce when you're under pressure. But that's what we saw today. And the decisiveness from Tyler Adams to get the ball, get on the half turn and not play wide, not play into the depth, but to play to another center midfielder and drive forward through the middle on the ground through the lines gave the U.S. another element of control today. And it's really a trait that the team has struggled at over the years. And the fact that they put it together, that they made it a main emphasis today of all days, stood out for me in over the 90 minutes.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I give some credit there on Sargent as well of holding, I think, a defensive midfielder and center backs where they could play vertical through that space, which, as you said, it's not something we ever really see the U.S. do. Also, there's a moment where early on in the game where the U.S. is pushing a little and Tyler comes and counter presses and deflects a ball off to the corner that Jedi chases down, who had a struggle today. And I also thought struggled at times against England, but that's another conversation. And that's where I feel like you get so much confidence for the other guys to say, yeah, I can take risks because we are counter-pressing. Our team is playing high and we're all there around us. Anything else specific about this game before I go somewhere else?
Well, you got to talk the second half.
Okay, right? Do it.
We got to talk, like, the game got away from the U.S. by about the 65th minute mark. And this is where I'm a little frustrated because I'm like Bobby. I like proactive subs. I like, you know, If you're not controlling the game anymore, you have to figure out what's going on with that. And I thought that Berhalter held on, like put him in his pocket for too long. And maybe part of that was Aaronson having to come on for Pulisic at halftime. But that's like, that's a thing now. Every time Aaronson comes in the game gets stretched. And there's not been an adjustment that I've seen from that. Now, I'm picking nits here because even with that, Iran, who's a good team, by the way, like this is not, you know, the U.S. didn't just smack Honduras. Like this is a World Cup caliber team.
Or with, Algeria in 2010, by the way. That was not a good team. This is a good team.
This is a good team. They didn't have any of the game until the start of the second half, maybe about the 50th minute. And then the game started getting away from the U.S. And there was the gap constantly between the front line and the midfield. And it started asking more and more of McKennie, who's clearly not 100%. And it started asking more and more of Musa, who, as great as he is, and I agree with everything we've said, he's my favorite player in the pool. Yunus Musa is my favorite player in the pool. He does not have, you know, Frankie Haydick or Landon Donovan or Michael Bradley style stamina at this point in his career. He doesn't certainly does not have Tyler Adams style stamina. So with those two guys, McKennie and Musa, getting a little bit disconnected from the front line, that's where the U.S. lost control of the game. Now, they were still good enough defensively. Tim Ream, Tyler Carter Vickers, I thought, had a good game. They and honestly, both fullbacks, even though I agree with you, Jedi has not had a good game attacking so far. He never stops grinding defensively. Those guys scrambled well enough to cut off any potentially profitable Iranian attack. But it was a different style of game because of that gap between the front line and the midfield. And I needed to see Berhalter address that. And he never really did until they went with five at the back and said, okay, we're going to be the team that's playing in the shell. At which point it would just became the Walker Zimmerman show where he must have won 15 headers in the last.
Can you say that again, Matt? Can you summarize that again on what part you thought they should have adjusted?
So when Aaronson comes in, and part of it is Aaronson just like he's going to press everything. He He plays like he's being chased by a swarm of bees. He does not naturally form connections with the midfield behind him. He's not that type of player. Whereas Pulisic, even when he's playing as a runner, which is what he was today, not a playmaker, he still is aware of the connections, especially defensively, with the midfield behind him. Aaronson does not do that. And then suddenly you get the center forward saying like, oh, he's pressed. I'll go up and press too. And then the weak side winger is like, oh, well, they're up. I'm going to come inside and I'm going to go up a little bit as well. And between that and McKennie and Musa, maybe, you know, running out of gas or in Weston's case, clearly feeling his injury, there became a disconnect between the front line and the central midfield. And that's when Iran started getting more of the ball in good spots. And it became less about rest defense for the U.S. and more about active defense and not smothering fires before they start, but putting out fires as they're happening. Does that make sense to you? Does that jive with what you saw?
I'm not sure it jives exactly, but I'm glad you brought it up.
Have we discussed, you said the Walker Zimmerman part, and I realized I don't think we've discussed sort of the lineup decision by Greg to start CCV over Walker. I thought it was a big gamble.
It was a huge gamble. And Stu Holden talked about it on the broadcast. He said, this was an attacking decision because Cameron Carter-Vickers plays for Celtic in the Scottish League. He faces a bunker every single week. Every single week, unless they're playing Rangers. And honestly, the last 10 years, if they're playing Rangers too, they face a bunker. And so he just has muscle memory playing against a team like that. Like when he gets the ball, and we saw it half dozen times, at least in the first half, the U.S. are recycling the ball possession on the left side between Ream and Robinson and Weston McKennie, because he played on the left side of that three-man midfield, which we have not seen recently. They're recycling, holding possession over there. And they play it out to Carter Vickers, and he has an acre in front of him. He's taking that space. Like, that is just what his training is for club, and he applied it for country. Obviously, Nashville do not play like that. Nashville are the team that play in the bunker. They're not the team that faces the bunker. So, and that, like, Stu said that on the broadcast in very, like, many fewer words than what I just used.
And the way it manifests, and I do think we saw this from Walker in the first two games, is largely on your decisions on when to play forward, when do you break a line, and when do you swing to your other center back. And that there were a couple times when Walker did not get that decision right in those first two games where he'd try and break a line and it got picked off, or he would decided to swing when perhaps he could have broken a line or played into the depth. So that for me is the primary decision. And I did think Walker looked shaky, so I can understand the adjustment for this game.
I agree. And I would say credit to Walker for coming off the bench then and playing at the level he did. And it was different, but man, you put that guy in the middle of a back five and you play balls in the air, he's a stud.
Yeah. It's hungry, hungry hippo time.
He's a monstrosity. And in fairness to him, Tim Ream and Carter Vickers at that point lost a decent amount of their battles. And so he was necessary in that moment. Ream and Carter Vickers defensively were incredible for 60 minutes of this game. Like, talk all you want about in possession, what they dealt with Osmoun and Taremi and how simple it was for them and how quickly they could win the ball back and get it back. There was not nervous moments where for the U.S. they go down 1-0. It's a whole new game. And none of that existed. I think that's credit to both of them and Carter Vickers for stepping in and being able to play at that level his first time in the World Cup. Ream has played now this full stretch with a yellow card, has not picked up a second one, which is also really impressive.
Tim Ream at this point has an argument for best defender in the tournament.
I mean, the U.S. is tied with pretty much right behind Brazil with best defense, and right? He has been the best defender. All right, Doyle, you convinced me. It took you a very long time, but you got me there.
2010 Red Bulls forever.
Yeah, for sure. As Hans Bock has said, his future is there. Bobby?
I just wanted to add one part about this game, which I don't know if the word, if ironic or the right word to summarize it, but I thought the two not defining parts that happened, right, were the mid block, basically a 4-4-2 mid block from Berhalter. And then how did the goal come? What was the main pass on the goal?
The long ball? Yeah, it was the diagonal to the overlap.
It was the ball is wide. It's played 15 yards back to a center midfielder, really a defensive midfielder in that moment. The defensive midfielder picks up their head and plays the ball along diagonal to the attacking outside back on the far post. And that there have been a lot of progressions over the last 3 years with Greg Berhalter, a lot of adjustments. And I thought that the main game that he will have in charge of this team, the fact that the two things that probably won them the game were the basics, the fundamentals that he came into this team with.
Let's talk about Greg Moore here, because we've waxed poetic about a lot of things. It was his job to get the U.S. from where they were on the men's side to where they are now. And this was the expectation. And not a single second of it was easy, including his hiring process and the perception around his hiring and the knowledge or lack thereof from a lot of people around what his successes have been and the way he coaches. And then you add in all of the challenges since then, both of building a new program, setting a record for debuts of players over the course of a cycle, playing the youngest team window in and window out through World Cup qualifying, having a shifted qualifying and COVID and all of that as we brought up at the top of the show, and trying to build a culture out of nothing from a young group. And it all came through the last 3-4 years. And Bobby, he qualified. He won the Nations League over Mexico. He won the Gold Cup over Mexico. And now he's qualified for the round of 16. If Greg Berhalter never coaches another game for the U.S. men's national team, that was his checklist coming in. And we now have to give him his plaudits for what he's accomplished.
Yeah. I obviously know Greg outside of just this and just soccer. So I acknowledge that I will have confirmation bias when it comes to parts of him, but you just read off his resume as head coach of this team. And I don't know how you can argue with that. Yep. And then from a soccer side, when you look at the way this team has played, and granted, a big part of this conversation depends on where you're starting it and the premises you come in with based on the talent and the quality of the team. I'm probably at a different side of that spectrum than other people are, because I do think that there has been a lot of praise and expectation before there's been much of a sample for it yet. But regardless of where you are, if you look down at the list that you want from a coach, right? If you look at the intensity and the focus that they bring, that's been a check in this tournament, and that's absolutely been a check in every big game that they've played. When you look at the ideas that they bring, does it look like the 11 players have a sense of what they're supposed to do in the different phases? That's a check. And that's probably a check plus compared to what we see from any other national teams, right? We always talk about how it's a simple sport at the national level. You need to keep it basic with your group. And from what we've seen over the three games, for two games for everyone and three games for some teams, this U.S. men's national team is more advanced in their ideas. And then you say, can they execute it? Are they on the same page? Because we've heard this 1,000 times about how at the national team level, you do not have enough time to work with a group, which is almost certainly probably been wrong this whole time and just a lack of actually looking back at history. But either way, it's proven wrong with this group and that they do work and execute together. So that's a check. And then the last part is the question mark, right? How are they doing and actually creating chances? How are they doing at the part that really the whole part of it, which is getting results? And that is still a TBD on this, right? Because we can praise the performances. We can praise the minute details of how they go through their rest defense and their phases. But ultimately, this is a team, the United States men's national team, that should be at the round of 16, that should be beating Iran, that should be beating Wales based on all the different factors that would go into those things. And this is still the to be determined and the exciting part, because it really puts stakes on the line. I appreciate that you applauded the team. I appreciate you guys are energized, but the team should be going into this round of 16 game with the expectation that they can beat a weaker Netherlands side right now. So also put a to be determined on that next part of fully getting the results in the meaningful games.
I think that's fair to want more and agreed. To push for more. And I think that's a lot of people. I would like to state, though, at this moment, Greg Berhalter is one win away from being unquestionably the most successful manager in U.S. men's national team history. If he gets to a quarterfinal and you add on to that,
without question,
the other trophies, he's there, right? There's no, oh, well, you haven't won Gold Cup. That does matter once you get to that. And if he gets to a quarterfinal equals Bruce Arena at that level, the resume from the numbers side will stand alone. Whether they get there or not is another question. The Netherlands coming up on Saturday. That'll be the early game on Saturday. So it'll be 10 a.m. Eastern time, I believe.
Yep.
Which means we're all going to have to get ready for another big game. Oh, no. Woe is us. I think this is exactly what we were looking for and what we were hoping we would get to do after all of this.
Wait, are we done? I hear in your voice, it sounds like we're wrapping.
Yeah, you're winding
up another hour. Weeby's still talking. He doesn't realize he's muted again. Like, this just keeps happening to him. Like, this show can be...
I've done Twitter spaces all year. Can I just say this? I completely agree with Bobby, but I'm also hopeful because I don't think we've seen the U.S. even approach the best they can be from sort of that final ball, final run, finish moment. Like, they've gotten by on largely, I think, the defensive side of things. And there have been a lot of moments where it's like, almost. Like, God, you just won away. Like, the angle could be better. The run could be well-timed. You could get your head up. There is more that Greg Berhalter and these players can wring out of their performances. And it's not like it's in a different universe. It's there. We just haven't quite found the moment, the rhythm, the composure, the vision, whatever it is in that individual instance of execution to get it there. And then if we're going to, you know, things that just little complaints, man, we've talked about the number nine so much with this team, and God bless Josh Sargent and his performance. I don't want to dump on Haji Wright, but that was dire. Yeah. Like, that, he did not provide a Sargent single thing.
And Ferreira does not start in the next game.
Just not a single thing that team needed at the end of the game did he provide. It was demoralizing to watch, and I feel for Haji because he's a better player than that. He didn't press. He had opportunities to hold the ball up. He had opportunities to have a little vision and keep it. He should have gone to the corner. Like, there were all these sort of situational end of game, this is your role moments that he came up short on. And you know, in the end, it's not going to be a memorable thing for people because, hey, we're on, we got through. But it is going to be a memory for Greg, I assume, looking at this next game, look at those moments. I mean, Jesus Ferreira's got to be thinking, hey, I'm a good presser. I connect passes. I may not be a hold-up player, but, like, I draw fouls. I run into the channels. And I'm very curious to see who plays that number nine. Hopefully Josh Sargent is okay against the Netherlands.
But... He was walking around after the game. He was walking around and smiling after the game.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Also, I got to put out there, I've been trying to process both the roster selection and some of the player selections over the last few weeks from Berhalter, because I don't want to say the word random, but there has not been a ton of fluid thought process with some of them, right? Some, well, are you part of the group? Well, this person's completely not part of the group. Well, this person's earned a spot, but this person's lost a spot. I mean, DeAndre Yedlin played poorly against Wales, but Shaq Moore played poorly against England, and Shaq Moore's back in there.
Yeah.
But I will give Berhalter credit for one thing. I don't know anyone else out there in the world, but I know the four of us have talked off air a lot about having a CONCACAF team and a non-CONCACAF team, like what it requires. Tim Ream is clearly not a CONCACAF player. And credit to Greg Berhalter for just doing it without really making it explicit and saying, if we get there, then I will use you. But you are not going to help me in Honduras, and you're not going to help me at home against Costa Rica after a long flight. But he helped you at a World Cup level, and he did something similar, it feels like, with Haji Wright as well. And it's worked for Greg Berhalter, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's something we've talked about a while. It never existed. And it was always, well, these are your 23 and these are your 23. And obviously now it's 26. And he just went with it.
Yeah, I think keeping the like window open with Ream, and this goes back to what I was saying about, about humility and about sort of the human side of things, of like just having the opportunity to go back to a guy and saying, hey, I think it's your time. And not having it be a poison situation, having that guy be able to come into a team like this, to come into a starting spot. I think in a lot of teams, correct me if I'm wrong, Bobby, but in a lot of teams, that's maybe not a poison pill, but that's hard for people to deal with. For a guy to come in and just be right into the starting lineup that hasn't been there with you, even the CCV change could be that as well. I think it speaks to sort of the culture of the team that they can sort of take this stuff on the chin. Even the Gio Reyna stuff that we haven't even said his name once in the show. He didn't play in this game, but like all
say
the drama.
Say his name, Weeby.
With Gio Reyna. And having to answer to Winalda's comments about it and having this guy not playing and he's coming out saying I'm healthy. I mean, I think they've done a good job of sort of closing things off and keeping it inside and putting the performances in they had to.
There's a question in the chat that I want to pose to you because it's a good question. I think one of the faults or one of the potential conversation points was the fact that Berhalter went to three center backs pretty early in this game, about 20 minutes left. Do any of you have a reaction to that on whether it was the right or the wrong decision?
I think most games it would be the wrong decision, but look, Weston was gone at that point. Obviously, De La Torre, who I like a lot, but it's at this point, it's like, why did you bring him? He's clearly too hurt to play. You can't bring him. And he's your guy who gets on the ball in tough spots, is a ball progressor, is a settled down the midfield, settled down the game type. He can't play. Moose is out of gas. You're clearly going to spend the last 20 minutes of the game defending. So I think this is where you could pick at, like, if Eric Williamson was there and you could have brought him in for McKennie or Paxton Pomacall or Keaton Parks, like maybe it's a different thing, but like Kellen Acosta is not that guy. And Kellen Acosta, because of the injury to De La Torre and because of the issue I talked about with Aronson pressing and creating that dislocation between the front three and the midfield, like you want another guy who's just a kind of a rock in there. So I understand why he did it, but like this is where my big beef with Berhalter is. I don't think that he necessarily picked the right depth pieces to make a really long run in the World Cup.
I do think that's an important point too. Like we kind of, hey, Greg, this, if he goes on, best resume, et cetera. That doesn't mean that it's been perfect, right? That doesn't mean that every decision is beyond reproach. That doesn't mean that if you had criticism for Greg that was all of a sudden moot and bury it 6 feet under. Like it within the process, there's room for criticism. And there's been times where I think he's deserved the criticism. It's just that when you get to the crucible and you have 270 minutes and your decisions are going to be ripped apart as everyone does, not just us, obviously. Like, you get credit when you get through it. You know what I mean? Like you get credit when the results come at the time that they were supposed to come and you pass the test.
I want to walk through the way I think that decision goes for a head coach. And I think that there's two main decision points you have when you think about that sub. The first is that when the game gets out of hand, the first decision you have to make is, what do you want to do to the temperament of the game? Do you put in a player to match the opposing team's aggression, to maybe make it ugly, to blow up what they want to do? Or do you bring in a player to calm it down and get control of the game again, right? This is the Luca De La Torre or Gio Reyna versus Kellen Acosta or Shaq Moore decision, right? So far in the Wales game and the Iran game, Greg Berhalter decided that he wanted to match the intensity, that he wanted to bring on someone that can be aggressive and slow down what the other team wanted to do. The second decision you have to make there, I think, when you specifically to go in three center backs, is, are we A, going to try and block up passing lanes or block up areas that they're getting to? Or B, is this game just going to be so ugly that we want an extra player in the box and an extra player who can win aerial duels? I hear what Matt said earlier about Brendan Aaronson's spacing. I did not think they had issues with spacing in this. And as someone who was playing center back, going to get brought on as a center back in these scenarios, I think most professional players would tell you that if you are not giving up key spaces or big chances, you absolutely do not want your shape changed, right? Leave us alone. We're doing fine. Don't panic. The second part to that, which I think was why Berhalter got this right, is that no matter what happened this game, they could have kept Iran at midfield. They could have blocked up every passing lane, and they were still going to get balls thrown into the box. Mm-hmm. And that is why you bring on the third center back and the Walker Zimmerman.
Yeah.
So hopefully that was a succinct enough summary about the two different ways to think about that and why, for me, it was the right decision in the end, even though there was a full 20 minutes left you have to deal with.
Plus, yeah, when any game enters the tactics free zone, that's when you bring the MLS guys on.
I'm gonna go ahead and my number is up. I've got to go make dinner for small children, but I'm going to be listening as you guys break everything down with Bobby's, of course, previewing Bobby's favorite team, the nice Netherlands. So I
agree with both of you, by the way. 99% of the time, I hate the fifth center back. Bye, Weeby. And this was the 1% of the time. And as I said, for Walker to be able to come back and after getting benched and be able to play at that level, pretty incredible. The U.S. is into the round of 16 of the 2022 World Cup. They move to the next round. The story remains, and we talked a few days ago on this show about the World Cup's been quick. It's been hard to get to the momentum. Stars haven't been built the way they normally will. It's gone so fast. I think these 4 days are going to be massive for these players and this program just to have and continue to be in the spotlight and continue to be talked about and, you know, become celebrities and all the things that happen when something special like this, whether it's an Olympics or a World Cup or a playoff run or whatever occur, that is a valuable amount of time on top of the opportunity to face off against a traditional power and a team I think many people who tune halfway into soccer will at least know has been on a pretty big stage, obviously a semifinal and a final over the last 12 years. Do you guys have any early thoughts about this matchup?
So the Dutch, this is a point Bobby made the other day when I was dunking on the Dutch after their game against Ecuador. They're really open in the midfield. And this is like a Van Gaal thing, right? They will open up the midfield. And so if McKennie finds his legs and Musa finds his legs, look, the U.S. should not play scared in this game. They should not be committed to playing 100% against the ball. Like, this is not Dennis Bergkamp's, you know, Netherlands national team. Like, this is a different type of thing where I think the U.S. will be able, if those top three guys are good to go, I think that they will find room to play. The issue is, if you come up and play, Gakpo and Depay are so good that, like, they don't need their midfield to have the ball. They don't need Dumfries and what's the left wing back that Bobby loves? They don't need those guys to be
Daily Blind.
Yeah, thank you. They don't need those guys to be incredible. Like, they could do something all on their own. But I, like, you're going into this game with house money. So, like, go in to win it. Like, don't go in for a nil-nil or a 1-0. Like, go in there and just pour it on.
And look at what Senegal did well, but especially what Ecuador did well, right?
Yeah.
Those are things that fit the U.S.
And what Ecuador did so poorly today, by the way. Yeah. Like, they came out with that back foot, let's not lose this game because all we need is a draw mentality. And, like, that is death. And I feel terrible for Ecuador because they played so well those first two games. But they let themselves down in the third.
And the chances will be there. If there's ever a game that this team's going to finish their chances and that's why they're going to win, right, which hasn't been the case so far, it's been the defense. This is the one because they're going to be there. That's the way this Dutch team plays, as you said, and that's what we've seen so far. If the U.S. can just be maybe, you know, outside the realm of possibility efficient, they can put themselves in the driver's seat to win. That one coming up on Saturday, this was a big moment. Everyone was waiting for it. Bobby, how are you feeling?
Well, let's just, again, lay the foundation for a few things. And coming to this tournament, we had defined, really just relaying what the betting markets, who are really the most efficient method of understanding how good teams are, that Netherlands were in the top nine favorites. They were in the bottom of those top nine, right? Them, Belgium, and probably Portugal were the fringe team in that, but they were the 3, 7, 8, 9, still favorites, but at the bottom of it. Why do we feel that way? Because they've made a World Cup final in the last decade. They've made a Nations League final, I believe, what was it, 3 years ago. So this team is still one of the world powers. That said, which I'm not really sure why Doyle disagrees with those premises or where that comes from. So, but that said, they have been extraordinarily unimpressive over this tournament. They won their group and they won their group.
I think Frankie De Jong is terrible. That's why.
It's because Doyle's a Barca fan.
He would not start for the U.S. team. I would not start Frankie De Jong over any of the three midfielders on the U.S. team.
Okay.
He'd be first off the bench. I'd take him over Kellen, but not by a lot.
Bobby, continue.
No, dude. Some things just you can't respond to, man. But if you're like, if the question is, what did we learn from these three games? It's nothing, right? Because it's not mutually exclusive to be a favorite for the World Cup and look bad in the group stage. To a certain extent, it's almost expected and normal for these Titans or tournament favorites to sleepwalk through three games. What I will hope is that it's a slightly longer extension for this Netherlands team and that they really are a team that's trying to figure themselves out, including the local previews. They weren't sure about the lineup. They weren't sure about the shape the team was going to play. They even locally did not know if this team was at an ebb or a flow right now. So if you're a US fan, you hope that they're at a lower point and that these three games are more true of who they are. And specifically to what Doyle said, that the way they play, and this is true if you've ever watched a Louis van Gaal team, that they want to keep the ball and they are very strict about their positional play, and it'll look like the center midfielders are on an ocean. And for the way the U.S. defends and wants to transition, that it's a type of game that suits them very well.
Yeah, and that's what we saw Ecuador do in that second game. Also, for anyone thinking about it, Bobby mentioned nine favorites. There are eight groups at the World Cup, and Pot A, where the strongest teams come out of in Group A, was Qatar. So whether you think the Dutch are great or not, whatever, there's an opportunity for the U.S. because any other World Cup, you're probably lined up against one of the big favorites who have won their group coming in because, quote unquote, the best seeded team was the host in Group A. There's an opportunity there to play a Dutch team that is a half step behind most of the other top teams in the group as we go through the next few days. And we see an Argentina, a France, a Brazil, a Portugal most likely win their groups. And the U.S. will be part of that final 16.
The final piece I want to add to this about the way the teams match up is one of the decisions that has mostly worked, but I would still be critical of, is that Greg Berhalter set up the U.S. defense in what I would say is a protective manner. Right, they are set up to limit the opponent's chances, not to create their own chances, which is part of the reason that they haven't had a ton of goal-scoring opportunities of their own. I think Netherlands are one of the teams who will give you the ball anyway in opportunistic places. The Netherlands are one of the teams that will try and play through the middle. They will try and play through the lines,
Are you calling a Tim Weah a hat trick? Is that what I just heard from your mouth, Bobby?
I'm saying that there are reasons to be very optimistic about this U.S. team and why we should almost that. Why? Yeah, sure. Tim Weah a hat trick. Why not?
All right. Welcome to the Brown Liquor Special, Bobby.
Flip side or spoilers, because we haven't even mentioned it. England won Group B. They beat Wales 3-0 today. Wales,
who cares?
Whereas Wales borderline national team. So we're done talking about Wales for the rest of our lives, which is probably nice for all of us. The Netherlands got through beating Qatar 2-0. So that clinched them first spot in Group A. We're going to talk about one more game and then we're going to be done here. Senegal, they will face off against England. Bobby, is there something?
It feels like we should do like two more sentences on the Netherlands.
We have 3 days, 3-4 days.
Okay, fair. Oh, a teaser, club and country every day, 5 p.m. Eastern.
We are live on Twitter Spaces. We also come out as a podcast. So search MLS Today, and you will find the feed for Club and Country Today, both on your podcast apps and on Spotify. But a historic game for Senegal. They move into the second round of the World Cup for the second time ever in their nation's history. A big day for the African Federation. In 2018, no teams out of Africa got into the second round of the World Cup. It feels like Senegal could be the first of potentially three teams that get through, maybe four if something ridiculous happens over the next few days. And Bobby, you mentioned it there, or maybe Doyle did. Ecuador came out not to lose because they got through with a tie. Mm-hmm. It was not the right mindset, and they were not able to control the game at all. We saw it bounce back and forth a bit, but in the end, Senegal get the historic win.
Yeah, it was the simplest narrative, the one you would expect to happen. And it's a team that only needed the draw, had the intensity of a team that looked like they only needed a draw. And Ecuador and Senegal are, even without Sadio Mane on Senegal, are effectively even talent right now. They had even expectations coming to the tournament. And Ecuador took 3% off the pedal, and it hurt them in the end. And then especially when Senegal gets the first goal, it's a game that shapes up well for them.
Yeah, it was just so heartbreaking to see Ecuador equalize and then immediately drop their level. Mm-hmm. Just immediate, like, because that was it, right? Like they gave up the goal and then they equalize, like the goal wakes them up and they start playing at least somewhat like they did against the Dutch and against Qatar, and they were so good in those first two games. They get the equalizer and they're through again, and instead of, you know, jamming the pedal down, they just immediately said, okay, we got the draw. We have the result we need. And they let off. And within 100 seconds, it was 2-1. Just brutal.
And Kalidou Koulibaly, if we had one today, free for life would be a simple one for him. His 67th captain gets his first career goal. And that's the difference for their team. And, of course, someone who just won AFCON. It was really him and Sadio Mane who led the team. He sees his brother and Mane go down. He's able to pop up with that moment. The celebration. We're seeing the videos come out of Dakar and everyone celebrating. It was also the 2-year anniversary of the passing of Papa Bouba Diop, who was the legend of 2002 World Cup, where Senegal got out of the group. He wore his number on his armband. I think it all just came full circle, and you saw it on the face of Ali Cisse at the end of this game. Senegal was Ecuador in 2018, right? They came up just short, undeservedly, I think. They were knocked out on yellow cards.
Ugh.
Out of the group stage to knock out.
I forgot about that.
Behind Japan and Colombia in a tournament in which Japan and Poland basically wink nodded and said, yeah, let's just let this finish as it is so Poland could get 3 points at a World Cup and Japan could get through losing 1-0. And I think you see the lessons 4 years on. And that was my message to my friends who are Ecuadorian of, okay, this was probably 4 years early. Unfortunately, the team's good enough. They were, like the U.S., one of those three youngest teams at this World Cup, and Ghana, that were so clearly different than the rest of the groups. And it's about getting experience at this level that's so huge. And so, unfortunately for Ecuador, they're on that side this time. But congratulations to Senegal for being on the other side. Well-deserved after what they've done. They get through the group without Sadio Mane. They now go face England, who they will be able to go toe-to-toe with. If you look at, for example, again, what the U.S. did with their defensive shape in a mid-block, keeping England in front of them, being able to shut them out and keep them from being dangerous. It feels like Senegal can do a lot of those things as well, because that's what they're elite at, and an opportunity to potentially go to the quarterfinals.
Who are you guys going to be cheering for in that game?
You already know this about us, Bobby. We cheer we cheer against the European teams no matter what, except for England, of course. We always cheer for England. So there, that's that game. As I said, Netherlands beat Qatar 2-0. Cody Gakpo, 3 goals in 3 games in the group stage. He is, alongside Mohamed Kudus, the young emerging star from this tournament, and his price is going up.
Does Tyler Adams count as a young player for FIFA? Because doesn't FIFA do 23 and under is young? If Tyler's still 23.
Oh man, I didn't realize FIFA was a 2016 MLS article.
Yeah, right.
I didn't know 23 was the cutoff.
It's pretty wild, isn't it?
They let you use your grad student year and a transfer year in there, and they still make you eligible.
This is Big 12 soccer
for sure. Tyler might be eligible for that one. Let's close things out with tomorrow. We still have simultaneous games to close out groups. We've got Group C and Group D, and boy, Group C is delicious. Poland sitting on first place on 4 points. They have a 75% chance of getting out of the group right now. With a win, they automatically qualify. With a draw, they are probably in. Argentina are second with the bounce back win, 3 points. Win and in, 100%. Draw, they also are probably in. Saudi Arabia sitting on 3 points. Win, they will qualify once again, but a draw probably won't be enough as they would move into a tie with Poland. If Poland don't win, then you start to talk about numbers. And Mexico sitting in last place on 1 point, and they need a multi-goal win to get in, and they need some other stuff to go their way as well. Saudi Arabia versus Mexico will be the headline one. On Fox and Telemundo, Poland versus Argentina on FS1 and Telemundo as well. And Bobby, this is one of those fun times when you're talking about four teams at the same time. It's not just the matchups. It's watching the other games. It's results affecting other results as you go through the 2 hours. This is like what the group stage is all about.
Who's on your screen tomorrow? Of those two games, who's the main one?
Every chance to watch Messi. This is his last World Cup. It's Messi's on my big screen.
Plus, I agree with that.
Plus Mexico are brutal. And you, the other night on this show after the Mexico loss to Argentina, you were talking about this matchup against Saudi Arabia, and you said something to the effect of like, yeah, 3-0 win, that is within the scope of possibilities of things that Mexico can do. We didn't have time for me to disagree, but because we're doing a 4-hour show tonight, I'm gonna disagree with that right now, Bobby. Like, I have seen nothing from this Mexico team that suggests a 3-0 win over Saudi Arabia, who are not good, but that suggests a 3-0 win is within the scope of possibilities.
The only thing I will counter with is Saudi Arabia needs to win. They have played a high line the whole tournament. They've made mistakes at the back to allow opportunities. I agree with you that this is not a Mexico team, which doesn't have a goal and did not have a shot on goal in the last game, look capable of it. Saudi Arabia, on the flip side, look capable of opening that door for you.
Let's just say that if Mexico does win by 3, you have to come on the next show and only say positive things about the English national team. Like, do a full monologue on why you would take Declan Rice first in your
team.
Declan
Rice is terrible. Declan Rice is awful. First, you have to get him out of Tyler Adams' back pocket, all right, if you want to put him on the field.
Getting back to the point, I'm with you. I'll watch Argentina-Poland, which for mostly Messi, but it is a shame because I do think that the Saudi Arabia-Mexico game will be more fun because they both need to win, and Mexico needs goals.
That's going to be the main one on my TV. I'm doing a little early consulting for Jurgen Klinsmann as future head coach of Mexico. So I'm just going to watch this one so I can be able to pass him my notes immediately when
he
takes over.
That's the real dream, isn't it? That's the absolute dream.
Listen, they need someone to start saying no to the establishment. I got a no man for you, and his name is Jurgen Klinsmann. So come on down. Then the final group we have tomorrow, at 10 a.m. to start things off, is Group D. France already qualified, and they will most likely be in first place. Australia sitting in second place on 3 points. Win, they lock themselves in. Draw, questionable. No, sorry, not questionable. Draw, and they are in. Denmark sitting in third place on 1 point, tied with Tunisia. Tunisia facing off against France. Australia versus Denmark. Doyle, how does Australia get into the round of 16 here?
Set pieces.
Okay.
Set pieces, headers. Like, what, you want me to analyze Australia tactically? They're going to hit a lot of long balls.
I'm excited to see Aaron.
They might even trap some of them and then connect another pass, but don't count on that.
Matthew Lecky up top and his son have stolen the hearts at the World Cup. Can they continue to do so?
The main part of this game will be if Denmark's attackers can play at least to their level and probably slightly above their standard level, because we know that the center backs are the core of the team. We know that the center midfield is also excellent. What they have not had so far are attackers who have made plays. And based on overall level and talent, the attackers are probably slightly below the rest of the group. They're young, they're on the rise, they're exciting, but they need big performances from them, especially from the way that Australia will likely step up. So that'll be the key variable for Denmark, is whether those young attackers can provide a big moment at some point.
Kasper Dolberg has done it in the past. Can he step up and give them a big moment? Can Christian Eriksen, can they create enough space for him? You'd assume not. That will be Australia's focus. But can he find the moment as well? On Tunisia, France, I'm excited for this one just from a cultural level. I think 7 of the Tunisian players were born in France, and there is obviously a ton of crossover, a ton of history, and the Tunisia crowds have been phenomenal at the World Cup. France, very little to play for, so you'd assume a rotated team. For Tunisia, if they win and their goal differential matches up against whatever Denmark would win by, they could get through to the next round for the first time in their nation's history. All right, that's all for us. Thank you to all of you out there for listening.
Were you done?
I'm not done. I'll go another hour.
That's fine. It's great. I'll close this. You open a Twitter Spaces and everyone could go right there and jump right back in, because it's been a lot of fun. But this is why we are here every single day, because the World Cup, you never know what's going to happen. There's so much to talk about. There's so much going on. Today, it was the U.S.'s day, and it was a special one. The United States men's national team, for the first time in 8+ years, is going to move on to the round of 16 at the World Cup. And they are back, I think, on the stage that many people expect them to be. So congratulations to Greg Berhalter, his staff, Anthony Hudson, Lucci Gonzalez, all the people that have worked with him over the course of the years, Ernie Stewart, Brian McBride as well, a lot of people behind the scenes who have made this happen. And as well, across all levels, right? All of these players, their youth coaches, their college coaches, their agents, their MLS coaches, their European club coaches. There's a lot of people that go into all of this happening, but you got to see it culminate on a big stage in a really big moment.
Doyle, do you think that Berhalter's concerned about the 2-striker, 1-attacking midfield setup of Netherlands and whether that
I assume that he's sending David notes to prepare him for his men's league playoff match that is apparently kicking off in, what, an hour, David? Are we doing a Twitter Spaces after your game tonight?
We can do a Twitter Spaces after our game where I have to play center back the full time as a mess. Okay. Thank you once again to all of you out there. We are here every single day, 5 p.m. Eastern time.
Be brave on the ball, David. Be brave on the ball.
That's never an issue for me. Trust me when I tell you.
What's the word you say most when you play center back?
Step.
I think it says a lot about a person.
I've got the Red Bull DNA in me. Unfortunately, I do not have the Red Bull physical training, but I do have the DNA and mindset. And if I can get everyone else to press, then I can run less in the end. All right. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back tomorrow, 5 p.m. Eastern time live. We will react to all of the games. We will talk about whether Mexico has had a historic day or the future for Mexico. The last 4 years has been about getting to the fifth game, getting through the round of 16 for the first time. There's a chance that it could be historic in the other direction and they could miss out on getting out of the group stage for the first time since 1982. So we'll be there with you to react, to talk about that. And of course, we're going to spend the next few days helping preview the U.S. and the Netherlands game coming up on Saturday, as well as talk all other things World Cup.
And as Hans Bach has said, step, step, and don't stop stepping.